Hello, and welcome to the sixth installment of Leaders and Lulz virtual discussion series.
Today we are joined by Corey Lewandowski, a political operative and pundit, as well as the former campaign manager for Donald Trump's successful 2016 presidential campaign.
We hope you enjoy the discussion.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Leaders and Lulz virtual discussion series. Today we are fortunate enough to be joined by Corey Lewandowski. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
So can you just give us a quick overview of your career so far?
Yeah, you know, I grew up in Lowell, Massachusetts, and started interning at the Massachusetts State House when I was about a freshman in college at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. I worked for a state representative who ultimately became a state senator, a Democrat by the name of Steve Pangiatakis. When I graduated from UMass Lowell, I went down to American University for a master's degree. I started interning on Capitol Hill for the last Republican congressman from Massachusetts, a guy by the name of Peter Torkelson. And then from there, served as a chief of staff to Congressman Bob Ney from Ohio and a professional staffer on the Hill for a U.S. Senator, ran some races around the country, and then had the pleasure to meet Donald Trump and ran a presidential campaign that turned out pretty well.
So did you have any formative experiences growing up in Lowell, or actually attending Lowell Catholic, where we're about to graduate next week, that drew you to politics at a young age?
Sure. Look, when I was 7 years old, I grew up on a street called Coburn Street in Lowell. It's in the Centerville section of the town. And we had at the time a state representative whose name was John Cox. He was a well-known guy, been there a long, long time. And my best friend growing up, his dad was a political guy, and we were in probably the second or third grade. And he said, "Hey, come knock on doors and put out these flyers all over the place." And I didn't even know what it was. And so I started doing that. And then I had the privilege to watch Ronald Reagan debate Jimmy Carter in 1980. I was 7 years old, so I'm old. And I didn't know the difference between a Republican or a Democrat, but I liked what Ronald Reagan said. And I said, that's what I want to do. I want to help guys like that. And then the rest of my career for the next, almost 40 years has been at some level of politics. And, you know, I've gone all the campaign schools at the Republican National Committee and graduate school and colleges and taught it all over the country. But there's nothing like being involved, but all started right in Lowell.
And so how did you initially get involved in the Trump campaign, rise up the ranks to gain such a coveted position as campaign director?
Well, I was very fortunate. You know, I invited Donald Trump to New Hampshire in April of 2014 to host an event we were doing to bring the early candidates for president in to have them talk to some of the stalwarts in New Hampshire. And I met Donald Trump for the first time on that April date in 2014. And I stayed in touch with him just as a common courtesy, thank you for attending. And by December of that year, he had called me and asked me to come to New York to meet with him. And I didn't know why. And I went into his office in New York City on the 26th floor of Trump Tower. I drove over from New Hampshire. And there, unbeknownst to me, he offered me the job to be what was then his senior political advisor. We didn't have a campaign, and we started to travel the country. And then by June, when he came down that famous escalator ride, I transitioned from the senior political director to Mr. Trump to the campaign manager for the Trump for President campaign.
And so starting off, the campaign must have been such a unique experience because he was kind of dismissed early on by people on both sides of the aisle. But as we all know now, he's the president of the United States. So what was it like as the campaign took off and as you helped guide that into its leading position?
Well, you know, a campaign for anybody who's never done one is every job you can imagine all at once, right? From a startup, trying to get a website up and running, to getting people on payroll, which didn't exist before, to get phone lines. So you name it, you've got to do everything. And that's true, whether it's a city council campaign, a state rep campaign, or a presidential campaign. And so, you know, it was an all hands on deck, and we were a very small organization. So not only was I the campaign manager, I was the receptionist, the chief cook and bottle washer. I'm the guy who made the coffee in the morning. I'm the guy who cleaned the coffee pot at the end of the night. I'm the guy who ordered the fax machine, because back then we actually had one, I think, the photocopier, and I filled the photocopier, you know, with paper. So we did it all, as well as traveling. And so it was real. The great part was, because Mr. Trump didn't have this expectation of being the front runner, like a Jeb Bush did, or maybe a Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz or others, we had the privilege to run the campaign the way we wanted to, which was not many consultants, very flat. And so everybody did everything, and we could be very selective about who joined the campaign because we really only had those people who wanted to see Donald Trump be successful.
So did you use any strategies with the media or the public to help him run and then eventually to help him win?
Yeah, look, Donald Trump, if you would have told me that a 70-year-old man at the time was going to fundamentally transform the way we campaign through the use of social media, I wouldn't have believed you, particularly because there were a lot of other candidates in the race who were much younger and much more proficient in that. But what Donald Trump was able to do, particularly through his use of Twitter, was to respond to stories that were out about him or to drive a narrative that we wanted to. And he started doing that by phoning into television talk shows, The Morning Joe, Fox and Friends, and he did that on a very regular basis. And he did that partially to dispel narratives that were false and partially to drive the narrative of the day. And to put it in perspective, we did 600 interviews with the New York Times. Think about that. 600 interviews with the New York Times, which meant on multiple occasions, we were doing 2, 3, and 4 interviews a day with the New York Times, different reporters covering different aspects. Other candidates, their strategy was, let's put a position paper together, let's distribute it, let's have experts review that position paper, and then let's hope that somebody writes a story on page A97 of the New York Times, you know, with a little paragraph. We believed in, and Donald Trump has really mastered, the ability to earn free media. The analysis that came back after the 2016 campaign was we earned $1.4 billion in free earned media. You can't buy that. Front page of the paper, lead story of every publication, you know, every news outlet was covering him. You saw it from the rallies. And the more we did, the more media coverage we got. And so we wanted to embrace that strategy. The other strategy we embraced was we embraced Donald Trump's wealth. Many times presidential candidates say, well, I'm not really that rich. And we saw that with Mitt Romney, who would, you know, drive to a location in one car, get out and get in an old jalopy, and then get in a car and show up at a campaign event and say, look, I'm one of you. We said, no, Donald Trump isn't one of you. He's got a beautiful 747 that we flew all over the country, right? He's super rich. I mean, he's got more money than he'll ever spend. He's worth $10 billion. We embraced it. We told everybody, that's the American dream. We want you to have what Donald Trump has. We want you to be as successful as him. And people looked around and said, hey, you know what? You're right. And we got a lot of backlash when Donald Trump said, I have a store that's worth more than Mitt Romney. It's called Gucci in New York. And they said, that's not true. And then they did the analysis and said, well, that store is worth $450 million. So yes, it's true. So embracing the media, which has pros and cons, and embracing Donald Trump's wealth were two strategic decisions we made early on, and it seemed to propel us to victory.
So particularly given everything that's happening right now with the president and Joe Scarborough on Twitter, do you think that Twitter is an asset or do you think it hurts President Trump's chances of re-election?
Well, it's the opportunity to bypass the media. You know, he's got about 80 million Twitter followers right now and across all the social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, et cetera, he's pushing about 200 million contacts. Now that's so important because it used to be in the old days, if you wanted to respond to a media story, you'd put out a press release or you'd hold a press conference, right? And it was a slow, painful process and the media didn't have to cover you. Here's what we would do. We would see a story, we'd be on the airplane flying somewhere because we logged over 1 million miles flying on the plane in that period of time. And he'd say, hey, put the tweet out, bing, which we'd call it bing. He'd make that noise, bing. And 30 seconds later, Fox News would say, breaking news, Donald Trump just tweeted the following, whatever it was. And so it allowed him to bypass the media. And look, there are people who tell me all the time, Donald Trump shouldn't tweet. He should be more presidential. Let me just remind everybody that when you're the president of the United States, everything you do is presidential. If he sneezes, it's a presidential sneeze. It doesn't matter what your perception is. It is the fact that he is one of 44 people in the history of our country to ever hold that office, being the 45th president of the United States. And so I say that because Donald Trump has completely and fundamentally transformed the perception of the presidency. And his ability to go directly to the American people through social media interaction, through Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, et cetera, has really fundamentally changed the way the media covers him. And he's used it to call out some media reporters who've reported stories that are inaccurate. And we've seen the backlash, which is swift and severe from the Trump, what we call the Trump train.
So like we were just talking about, the president has had a very contentious relationship with the media right from the start. How do you think the media treats him compared to other candidates and other politicians? And how did that affect how you led the campaign back in 2015, 2016?
Well, it was amazing because at first they all loved him because he's so accessible. And to this day, the media will tell you he is the most accessible president from a media perspective in the history of the country. But you know, the way I believe they have treated him, and we have now seen the CBS, the former CBS news president just came out this week and said there is an inherent bias at the media. We know it's not just against Donald Trump. We see the way that Justice Kavanaugh, when he was conservatives in most of the mainstream media, because it's easy to attack them. It's easy to call people racist and xenophobic and haters without having to back that up. And so I think that by and large, the media has done a disservice to the American people by always chastising the president. And that now reflects in the approval ratings of the media. And what we're seeing information because they don't believe the bias, which is pervasive in the media, and the media's approval ratings are somewhere around the same level of Congress, which is like 2%. Okay, maybe it's 7, but you get the point.
So obviously the media was very influential in the campaign overall. Did you ever feel attacked by the media, or did you have a contentious relationship with the media personally or publicly that you felt affected yourself or the campaign?
Yeah, I mean, look, I have, if I had not lived this every day and saw what they say about people, which is just factually wrong, it's amazing. Look, let me give you one example. I've been very open and very candid. I've had to testify in front of Congress on 6 separate occasions, okay? In between the House and the Senate, the Judiciary Committee, the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, and the Mueller investigation. There was a story that came out in 2018 that said Corey Lewandowski swore at Democrat members of Congress, said, I'm not going to answer your effing questions. That's what CNN reported to be factually accurate. Well, now the truth is those transcripts have been declassified. Anybody can go and look at them. They're all available. That conversation never happened, right? And so they, and I told them when they called me, that's not true. And they said, we're reporting it. We know it to be true. So they did that to disparage me. And what they did specifically in that particular instance was they said, Corey Lewandowski didn't like being questioned by a woman. And they made it that Congresswoman Jackie Speier asked me a question. And I was so outraged that I had to swear at her, which never occurred. And so the transcript, which has now been declassified for everyone to see, could see that that was not accurate. But it, at the time, there were multiple stories that Corey Lewandowski has a problem with women. Corey Lewandowski is terrible and couldn't control himself. Well, none of that was true, but there's no apology from CNN. There's no apology to my family for disparaging me and saying things which aren't true. And that's partially because I'm a Trump supporter and I'm an unapologetic Trump supporter. But I think, look, my family has now unfortunately become immune to what is said about me because they have to be. And the worst part is I've got 4 kids who are still young, but they can read because they're between the ages of 9 and 13. So they can get on social media. They see what is said. And really it's my mom, right? Who, you know, she loves her son. I don't know why she does, but she does. She loves me. Okay. Because that's my mom. And so it's so disappointing for your friends and family when they have to read stories about you which just aren't true. You know, when Corey Lewandowski is treated one way and someone does the same thing, they're treated a different way. And look, you go back to the campaign, the incident with Michelle Fields, where they said, I dragged this woman to the ground. If you read the police report that she files, it says I kicked her in the face with my foot. and stomped on her head, okay? Those things never happened, okay? There's video evidence of this. The only words I've ever said to Michelle Fields in my entire life were, excuse me, as I walked by, and thank you. Those are the only words I've ever said to her. So a grand total of three words. But you would think that it was the Zapruder film shooting JFK. It was frame by frame. Corey Lewandowski moved past her and threw her to the ground, okay? I grew up in Lowell. I know how to throw a guy to the ground. I've done it many, many times, okay? I've gotten in many fights growing up in Centerville, because if you didn't, you're going to get in trouble. So let me tell you something. I know what that's like. But the way they treated me compared to someone else who does the exact same thing, and 2 years ago, this happened in the Boston City Council, where a Boston City Councilor pushed a reporter aside, and they said, nothing to see here. Move along. Move along. I was very fortunate at the time that Donald Trump, as candidate Trump, said, I'm not going to ruin a man's life because of the way he's being treated by the press. But it was devastating to my friends and my family who saw the same video I did, which was I literally walked past a person just like you would at a River Hawks game or something else and said, excuse me, as you walk by him because maybe you brushed against him. But look, that's what the media is. And it's really disappointing because I think it's going to impact future journalism when people who want to participate in the process say, maybe I'm going to choose a different profession.
I definitely agree with what you're talking about. Like, you can just watch the video and it's not what they were saying. Like, the media was hyping it up. And talking about what the media was hyping up as well, what was it like to work with the Mueller investigation? Because you kind of played a role in part two of the report. And what do you think the result of that was after 2 years of work and millions of dollars of investigation by the special counsel?
Well, the worst part is, you know, what we heard from Adam Schiff, or I call little Adam full of Schiff, and many others, right? Eric Swalwell, President Swalwell, and all these others, okay? What we heard from them was that there was irrefutable evidence that the Russians colluded with the Trump campaign. We heard it publicly for a long time. So Bob Mueller launched an investigation, had a series of 13 angry Democrats serving to look into this. But what we didn't know, or what I didn't know, I guess more accurately, until the transcripts were released, was that every person that the House committee called to testify, all 53 of us whose transcripts were released, all said the same thing. There was no collusion. We found no evidence that the Trump campaign colluded. And the very truth is, we couldn't collude with ourselves. We ran such a nascent campaign, such a small operation, that if you thought we were masterminding some Tom Clancy spy novel that we're going to get the Russians to help us win the election when we didn't know who our Pennsylvania state director was at the time, you guys got to be kidding me. I mean, look, I mean, that's really what it was. And so the whole thing was such a farce. It really put a cloud over the presidency for the first 2 years. And what I think U.S. Attorney Durham is doing now, which is looking into the origins of how this began. We know that it's unequivocal. There's empirical evidence that the Clinton campaign paid Perkins Coie Law Firm, who went and hired Christopher Steele to produce this document. We also know, and I was there at the time, I wasn't in the room, but I was there at the time, that then acting director James Comey produced that dossier to Donald Trump in January of 2017 when he was President-elect Trump. And then the next day it was leaked, and it was leaked as a document presented to the president-elect in a security briefing. And that's when this whole thing took off. We know that Bruce Orr's wife, Nellie Orr, handed him the document at the State Department, and he hand-walked it over to Andy McCabe at the FBI. We know unequivocally that Andy McCabe lied under oath on three separate occasions on the day that James Comey was fired as the FBI director in May of 2017. But we also know that none of those people have faced any prosecution. And so I am hopeful and cautiously optimistic that U.S. Attorney Durham is going to bring justice to the people who attempted to perpetuate maybe the greatest crime in American history. And one other point I'll make, and then I'll stop on this topic, is if the Russians did try to interfere, or the Chinese, or anybody else, in the U.S. election in 2016, the only individual who's responsible for the integrity of our ballot process at the time is Barack Obama, because Donald Trump was a private citizen. He had no more authorization to order the FBI, the CIA, the DIA, or any other government agency to investigate anything because he was a private citizen. And that fact is often overlooked. So I want to just put that in context that, look, in 2020, we believe, I'm sure, people are going to try and influence the election. And that's on Donald Trump's watch. But in 2016, he was Mr. Donald Trump, private businessman from New York. He couldn't direct Comey, Clapper, or Brennan to do anything. That was all under Susan Rice, Ben Rhodes, and Barack Obama, and by extension, Joe Biden.
So kind of switching gears a little bit. As someone who knows the president in a way that very few others do, what is he like behind the scenes? Is he different from his public persona, or is that kind of the same thing?
He's the most magnanimous, friendly, funny, self-deprecating person that you can imagine. You know, I had the privilege to talk with him just this week, and I'm probably going to spend some time with him today here in Washington. But he's got the weight of the world on his shoulders, and I mean that, right? He's the leader of the free world. And when I talk to him, his first question is always, how's the family doing? How are the kids doing? What's new in your world, Corey? Hey, how am I doing? Have you seen the latest sports event? Or, you know, he wants to talk about things that normal people want to talk about because, you know, I think I'm at a unique place with my relationship where he and I are just friends. I don't need or want anything. I've had the amazing privilege to be in the Oval Office and fly on Air Force One and travel with him all over the country. And so now we just talk about things that normal people talk about, right? I don't say, sir, let me give you my opinion on the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula because he doesn't care for it, and I don't have any core competency to give him that topic. But, you know, do we want to talk about Tom Brady and Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson and Manning playing golf? You bet we do. That's what people want to do, right? And look, having a break from the confines of always talking about politics, I think is a nice outlet for him and for me. And so, you know, I spent all that time in the campaign, and there was one stretch of the campaign where I had been living by and large at Mar-a-Lago in Florida for north of 60 days. I hadn't been home, hadn't seen my family, had the privilege to talk to him on the phone, but didn't go home. And my family's up in New Hampshire, and my kids at that time were 4 years younger than they are now. So my 9-year-old's a 5-year-old, right? And, you know, you miss your family, obviously, you miss birthdays and all those things. And he said, hey, Corey, how about we send the plane up and we fly him down to Florida? You can spend the weekend with him. I know, and the reason he instills, I believe, such loyalty from people is because of the way he treats others. And I'll tell you this, the first time I ever got on what we call Trump Force One, that 757, that beautiful gold-plated 757 that we took all over the place, he said, Corey, anything on this plane is now yours. You don't ask me for anything. If you want to go to the kitchen and get something, you want whatever, you just help yourself because what's mine is now yours. And he meant that genuinely. I didn't have to be part of the team for 25 years to prove myself. He wanted to know that once you're on the team, you're on the team, and that's the graciousness of this president. You know, he gave me this beautiful silver, fancy thing that I brought home to my wife. Look, I'm from Lowell. I don't know what the hell it was, but it was very fancy, okay? Sterling silver. And he said, you know, I'd really like your wife to have this. And he gave it to me right from, you know, the Oval Office as a gift just to say thank you. He didn't need to do that. You know, he doesn't need to call my kids at Thanksgiving and say the things that he said. And look, one of the most humbling things for me has been the leader of the free world, the president of the United States, calling my kids and saying, hey, I'm here because of your dad. Now, that's not true, right? And maybe I had a little part in helping him be successful. But for him to say those things to my children, who, you know, will never forget that, is part of the reason why I am such a strong advocate for him when I see him being what I believe to be unfairly attacked.
So kind of on that same part about, you know, kindness and more of a personal relationship in politics, how do you think the nation as a whole and both political parties can move away from toxic partisan warfare that we're currently in and have been for a long time and move towards kind of more bipartisan dialogue?
Look, I don't think there's any question right now that we as a nation should come together and grieve the 100,000 Americans who died from this coronavirus. I don't think there's any question that what's taking place right now in Minnesota, the death of a man who was in police custody, should not rise to the level of discussing this for every person in America. Nobody should tolerate that, and nobody does. And I think there are so many things that we can do to bring our country together, including but not limited to finding a solution to the coronavirus, putting 40 million Americans back to work, allowing our economy to be the envy of the world, which is what we were before this pandemic hit. That's not a Republican or a Democrat ideal. That's an American ideal. Nobody wants to see Americans out of work. No one wants to see a GDP of minus five or unemployment of, you know, 25, right? But we have grown so partisan. And I know, look, everyone says in the heyday of Washington 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, it was different. Maybe it was. And I wasn't here then, but maybe it was different. But where we are today is there are so few friends and colleagues on the other side of the aisle that you become an anomaly if you have them. And look, I've got a friend on the other side of the aisle. Her name is Donna Brazil. I don't know. I don't know if you know her. African-American, used to be the head of the Democratic National Committee. She was Al Gore's campaign manager way back in 2000. And Donna and I are great friends. And we have such a unique friendship that we can be honest with each other. And we can agree to disagree on politics. And she doesn't like some of the things the president does, and I don't like some of the things Joe Biden does. But we can all agree that as a country, when we're together, we're stronger, right? And I think that's, in the last 20 years, this coronavirus pandemic should teach us one thing. Politics is important. Okay, it's important. Okay, it's a lifeblood of so many things that we do. But there are things that are more important. The health and safety of the American public, the strength of our economy, taking care of our men and women in uniform should be more important, particularly as we just passed Memorial Day. Remembering those people who made sacrifices to give us these freedoms, that's not politics, right? That's the American values. And I think if we go back to some of those as a country on both sides, we'd be a hell of a lot better off.
So also on the topic of the ongoing pandemic, in the past, you were the National Director of Voting Registration at Americans for Prosperity. How do you think that the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic is going to affect voter registration as well as turnout come November?
Well, you know, it's a great question. Something that we should know is that the general election ballots in the earliest states start going out on September 3rd, right after Labor Day, right? And so what we're seeing now is an increased desire by people to vote absentee, not vote in person, right? And the reason for that is because they're afraid, I think, candidly, right? They don't know what's going to happen. They want to continue socially distance. They've been told that that's the right thing to do. And I think America has done a good job of it by and large. But we have to make sure that we keep integrity in the process. And you hear these stories, and maybe some are anecdotal, maybe some are not, where people say, hey, at my home, I received a ballot for a person who hasn't lived here in 20 years. Hey, at my home, I received a ballot for someone who died 5 years ago. Look, that means there is always the potential for voter fraud. And I think what we have seen in this country is that our election integrity is so critical. So I think states are now starting to allow people to go back to the ballot booths to start in those Democratic primaries. Look, Joe Biden is going to ultimately be the Democratic nominee, and he's going to secure that either June 2nd or June 9th. He'll get to the requisite 1,991 delegates because he's on the ballot. But I think as the country continues to open, people are going to be more comfortable. But many states have a history now, and a good history, of mail-in ballots. We see that in Colorado. It's an all mail-in ballot program, and they've done so with integrity and quality assurances to make sure that it's done accurately. We have to be careful. We have to make sure that ballot integrity is there and election day voting should be an option. The other thing that we have to make sure we're checking on, and something that's very near and dear to my heart in my home state of New Hampshire, and this may sound crazy, is the only people who get to vote in the New Hampshire election are people who live in New Hampshire. And maybe that sounds like a crazy idea, but if you are not a resident of the state, I don't think you should have the privilege to vote in that state. That I have no interest of going down to Massachusetts and voting down there, or Texas or Louisiana or anywhere else. We should be obligated under the rules to vote in the state that you're a resident of. And so if that continues to stay in effect, I think we're going to see an increase in voter participation, but we also have to make sure we're doing it smartly with the necessary processes in place so that only the people who are supposed to be voting are voting.
And so if you don't mind us asking, you are a favorite to run for Senate in New Hampshire. And we're wondering what led you to turn down that opportunity. And do you ever think you will run for any other public office in the future?
Well, look, I think if I would have ran, I would have won. That's the problem. And I'd have to work in Washington, D.C. every day and, you know, be one of these, you know, U.S. senators. And look, hey, I'm a kid from Lowell, Massachusetts. And I don't say that in a pejorative way. I say that and I wear it on my sleeve. Very proud of it. I have a great life. I've got a great family. I've got great privileges to spend time with the president. To go down to Washington, D.C. and be a United States senator is an amazing experience that so few people have, okay? But it's not my life goal. It's not my life goal to go down and legislate and become part of the problem. I'm a solutions-oriented guy, right? I see a problem, I go fix it. And I get frustrated thinking that, you know, if I would have run for the U.S. Senate and won, Mitch McConnell, who I respect and know, would be telling me which committee assignments I would be on and which votes I would have to cast a certain way. Hey, nobody tells me what to do. Okay, not even me. I don't even tell myself what to do half the time. I just go with my gut, right? Because that's what I've grown up with. And by the way, it served me very, very well. So the opportunity to run for the U.S. Senate was a very humbling thing. And I had support from around the country, and I would have raised a lot of money and had the support of the president, I believe. But it wasn't the right time. Is there elective office in my future? I don't know. Right now, my priority as the senior advisor to the President of the United States and to the Vice President of the United States is to make sure that they are reelected in November. And then, hey, in 2 years from now, in 4 years from now, if I am in a different spot, maybe I decide, hey, I want to run for governor. I want to run for the U.S. Senate. I don't know. Or maybe I do what everyone else seems to be doing up in New England, is moving to Florida and getting a great tan. I'm not sure.
Okay, so lastly, you've obviously had a lot of political experience. So what do you think makes an effective leader and someone people can get behind? And how do you think on all of society, people can get involved and civically engaged to make their own impact?
Well, look, I think the most important trait of a leader is decision-making. Make a decision. Hey, I make the wrong decision every day, 1,000 times a day. But you know what? I made the decision. Should I have had the Dunkin' Donuts iced coffee today? Or should I have gone with the hot coffee today? I picked ice, okay? That's what I wanted. Maybe it was the wrong decision. I actually say at over 60 degrees outside, I go with it. Stagnation is the worst thing you can have. And so when you are a leader and people want to follow you, be decisive, be clear, be crisp, give them the instruction. The other part of being a leader, I think, and Donald Trump did this every day, and I tried to do it every day with my entire staff of hundreds of people, is I never asked people to do things I wasn't willing to do myself. I never asked people to come into the office at 7 when I showed up at 9. I never asked people to work longer hours than I did, never asked people to do things that I wasn't willing to do or have done myself. And I think you lead by example. Now, is it always easy? Of course not, right? Being a leader is hard, but leaders are special. And there are so few of us, right? So when I grew up in Lowell, Massachusetts on Coburn Street, I would go up to McPherson Park and I'd play basketball every day that I could, right? And I learned at that park, hey, either you're a leader or you're a follower. Either you're the guy who's trying to decide what the next game is that you're going to play, or you're the guy letting someone else decide. And I want to be a leader. And I took that with me all the way through UMass Lowell when I graduated, when I was part of the student council, when I was the treasurer of my class at Lowell Catholic, right? I wanted to be a person who's making the decisions because I didn't want to blame somebody else if it didn't go the way I wanted. And so all the way through to the campaign, making decisions of where to send the candidate, how to get him to where it is, what our messaging was going to be, wasn't always right, right? I made a lot of mistakes. I make mistakes every day, but be a leader. So my advice to the next generation of leaders is don't be afraid to fail. Look, when I moved to Washington, D.C. to go to American University for graduate school, I had an offer to go work in the library. It was a paid job to go work in the library at American University. They were going to pay me like $7 an hour as a work study job. or I can go work for free on Capitol Hill as an intern. And I called my mother, who I respect above all. I said, what should I do? She said, well, it's very easy. You have no money. We're poor because we're from Lowell. And so you need to live. So go take the $7 an hour job at the library. And I said, I'll hate it. And I went and I worked for free. And I started to work for a congressman for free in January of, I think that was 1996. And by, you know, August, I had a full-time job and I made $900 a month and I thought I was rich. Now, and by the way, you know, before I left Lowell, I never knew anybody who actually owned two cars. It was amazing, right? Because I mean, that's just where we grew up, right? And then within 2 years after that, through hard work, dedication, a lot of luck, and I think hard work creates your own luck, I was the chief of staff to a congressman and just kept doing my thing and kept, and when people say you can't do it, I would prove them wrong because that's that chip on the shoulder. And I wear it as a badge of honor. And I think that's what people have to do, right? And I have no problem. And I do it all the time. I say, hey, man, I'm from Lowell. I can do you. You tell me I can't do it, I do it all the time. If you would have told me growing up on Coburn Street in a house that was probably 1,100 square feet, that not only someday would I get to meet the President of the United States, which would have been beyond my wildest dreams, but that someday I can call the President of the United States a friend, I'd say impossible. But that's how great this country is. And the hard work and the values that I had from my family and my grandparents and the church that we went to all led me to have the confidence to be able to do things that people told you you could never, ever do. Hell, I wrote 2 New York Times bestsellers. I could barely read. Right? And I say that kind of half jokingly, but I was never the straight A student. I was never the guy who was going to be valedictorian. I didn't make it to the National Honor Society because I was out, you know, skipping first class so I could go to breakfast with my friends, but as long as I can make it to the basketball games, right? I mean, that's what I want to do. And now I've got 2 New York Times bestsellers. I've taught at Harvard. I've taught at Stanford. I've taught at Oxford. I've taught at the University of Chicago. I mean, I may be someone who's recognized as one of the foremost political experts, at least on this president in the entire world. All because I refuse to say no. So anybody who is a potential future leader, don't let anybody ever tell you you can't do something, ever.
So that is all the time we have for today. And we'd like to thank our partners, America's Promise Alliance, Nancy Donahue, and the Greater Lowell Community Foundation. Thank you to all our listeners and viewers. And most importantly, thank you to Corey for being with us today.
Thank you, guys.
We hope you enjoyed our discussion with Corey Lewandowski.
To learn more about Leaders in Lowell, please check out our website at leadersinlowell.org and our Instagram at leadersinlowellofficial. We hope to bring you many more discussions with leaders in the coming weeks, so check our website and social media accounts for all the info.
Again, thank you to Corey, and thank you all for tuning in. We hope to see you again soon.